there's prayer requests as part of the announcements, but we didn't have any today, but we do have one. So if you'd share about your dad, please.
My father, Richard Weiner, he had two mild strokes, I think on Wednesday it was Wednesday day. And he was, you know, he listened to the program back in the early 60s, and he was baptized in the mid-60s. So he's been a Sabbath keeper for, you know, 40-plus years. His left side, he can move it a little bit, but he's going to take a lot of therapy, and he's having a hard time swallowing, and he can speak. So, and they did take the blood clot out of his neck. So, but pray for Richard Weiner, is his name, Richard Weiner, and he's 84 years old, and he's a servant of Christ.
Thank you, Alan. Known Mr. Weiner for a long time. Hard-working farmer. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to the visitors that we have. It's nice to have you. About 5 years ago, it was in January, Hugh gave a sermon that he titled Overview of the Book of John. He had recently studied the Book of John, and he shared some of the things that he had noticed in his study, and he put it all in one sermon and called it an overview. He summarized the differences between the synoptics and John. He explained what synoptics meant. That's the other three gospels, and he explained the derivation of the word. He reviewed some of the major themes of the book of John, and he encouraged us to study the book on our own, to meditate on what it had to say, and to compare it with the other gospels. And here it's 5 years later, I'm finally getting around to it. Just in my regular Bible reading, I had gone through the book of John, and I thought, you know, I don't understand this book. Kind of made me feel, as I wrote to a friend of mine out in the Midwest, I said, you know, I didn't say makes me feel stupid, something like that, but I said, makes me realize how little I understand when I was reading through the book of John. So what I'd like to do, well, what I want to tell you, first of all, is that you've heard, most of you that are here regularly, you've heard me give many, many sermons, but for those of you that don't hear me all the time, I've given a lot of sermons on the context of the Scripture, especially the New Testament. What happened between the Old Testament and the New Testament, what the world was, the Roman Empire was like, the time of the New Testament, what daily life was like, especially for women, gave a series on that in that world. So I have enjoyed my study for probably about the last 5 years of the context of the world in which the New Testament was written and which it took place. And I have liked to go deeply into it and figure out where, you know, just what was going on. Now, when it comes to the book of John, I haven't wanted to go deeply into that. And the reason is, I'm just sharing this personal thing with you, the reason is because, as Hugh said in his overview sermon, the Gospel of John is so different than the other three. And so when I went into the context of the Gospels and understanding the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, oh, it all fell into place, falls together, I understand it, I know where, I kind of get a feel for where people are coming from and what's going on. And then I read the book of John, and it's like, whoo, it's totally different. It's like John was on a different planet. Well, it's not really that way, but it's written from a different perspective. And it was written at a different time, and there are a lot of differences, some of which you covered. So it was something that is difficult for me because it doesn't fit in to the context that I've already developed in my brain. It doesn't fit in as well as I would like it to. So it takes more work. I guess it boils down to laziness. It takes more work to understand it. And I'm in the process of applying the effort. I am not through the study, but I have begun. I've read through the book, and I've begun the study. And over the next several sermons, I want to share with you some of the things that I've learned. Let's see. This series, as I study the Gospel of John, I want to share with you some of the things I've learned. I want to give you more detail. I don't want to cover the same ground that Hugh covered 5 years ago, although many of you weren't here then. But today, specifically, what I want to do is review the who, the what, and the when, some of those things Hugh covered, and also spend some more time on maybe the how and the why of the book. And after that, we'll look at the structure a little bit, the structure of the book, and that's one of the amazing things I've learned, that there's a structure to it that, you don't learn until you study it. I mean, because sometimes we go there and we read a verse, or we read a section, or we read a story, and we want to get something out of that story, and that's just fine. But when you read through the whole thing, like as if it were a novel, as if it were a separate book, it has a structure of its own, and it has a story to tell in a way that it tells it, and it's very interesting, and I'll share some of that with you as well. And perhaps maybe even speculate, because it doesn't always say, speculate as to why it's organized the way it is, and what's going on in the world that John wrote in, led him to write it in the way he did. So that's what we'll do today, and this sermon series will continue. I think I speak again in 2 weeks, and I may not speak again until after I come back from Thailand. I'm not sure, but at least the next couple of times will be from the book of John. That's my intention. I encourage you to look back at your notes or go on the Church of God Central PA website and listen to Hugh's sermon. It's a good sermon. It's January of 2009. So I don't want to cover the same ground that he covered, so I encourage you to listen to that or review your notes from that sermon back in 2009. All right, the who. Hugh covered that. Scholars want to argue as long as the day is long about who did what. Hugh covered it. Irenaeus, who was a disciple of Polycarp, who was a disciple of John, said that he learned that John was the apostle John was the one who wrote the book. The book itself, several times, identifies the author, but it does it this way. It says, well, it's the one who Jesus loved. It's that beloved disciple. It never gives him a name, right? the odds-on favorite is John, the apostle John. That's what we tend to believe. And there are early attestations, both Irenaeus and also Eusebius, historian, early on in the church, credits the Apostle John as being the author of the gospel that bears his name. How about the what the book is? It's very different, and we'll spend time on this through the whole series, but it's very different than the other Gospels. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. Hugh pointed out some of the differences. For instance, the Gospels have lots of parables. How many parables in the book of John? Anybody know? No parables. No parables in the book of John. John's got long conversations, right? Of detailed conversations between Jesus and other people. The other Gospels don't have that to speak of. They've got conversations, but not long, in-depth ones. Hugh pointed out in his sermon, I encourage you to listen to it, that there's a discussion, I think he pointed out in the sermon, there's more discussion about not just what Jesus said, but what he meant by what he said. The book of John has more about that, more about why he said what he said. Let's see. No parables, no genealogies. And there's probably a good reason for that. It's not no genealogy, no birth story at all. Jesus appears on the scene as an adult. And why is that? Well, we'll talk about some of those things. There's a focus in the book of John on Jerusalem, whereas the other Gospels spend a lot of time, more time, up in Galilee. And we've talked, we've had sermons about some of the parables and some of the things that happened up in Galilee. I've tried to share with you a little bit about the topography and so forth. But the book of John takes place more in Jerusalem. And more, well, there's reasons for that, and we'll get into that. Now, I'd like to spend just a minute or two, I'm going very quickly through these things. Most of this is covered in Hugh's sermon. That's why I want you to listen to that or review your notes. Hugh reviewed briefly some of the evidence for when the book of John was written. This, I think, is significant. If you want to understand context, if you want to understand why something's written in a certain way, you've got to really know when it was written, what was going on in the world at the time it was written, and we're going to spend some time on that today. most of the scholars believe that the book of John was written late in the first century. We'll talk about that. We'll talk more about that in some detail later. I don't want to go into that too much now. how the book, or how and why? You know, why is the book written the way it is? Why do we have these long conversations? Why don't we have parables? Why don't we have genealogies? There are good reasons for all of that. I'm not saying that we know all the reasons, because it doesn't say. But I'm going to, as I tend to do when I like to give these contextual type sermons and messages, I'm going to give you a little bit of the context behind the world that it was written in. And I think when you understand the context, as I have tried to do, it starts making sense why John wrote it the way he did, why the things are written the way they are, why they're presented the way they are. For instance, Hugh pointed out that the Jews, the term the Jews, appears in the book of John 64 times. 64 times. In the other three Gospels, there's three other Gospels, the term the Jews is only in there 16 times in all three books. Is there a reason for that? Well, yeah, there is. And we'll talk about that. What can we learn from that? What can we deduce from that? What can we, in some cases, maybe guess? I mean, some might be a little bit of guesswork, but I think it'll help the book to come alive for you. So let's talk a little bit about the date. I can give you some hard facts. One of them is that the book of John appears in some early papyri, some of these early copies of scripture that were found in the Egyptian desert, and or the, I think it was the Egyptian desert, the desert down there somewhere, and as they're dated at in the first part, or toward the middle, I should say, the middle of the first or the second century, maybe as early as 125 A.D. Now, in order for them to have spread from where it was written to there, and to have general acceptance, it would have taken, you know, would have taken decades probably. So it couldn't have been written any later than probably about 110. That's an upper limit. It couldn't be written later than that and appear in these papyri just a few years after that. So that shows it can't be something that's later than that. Now, trying to figure out how early it could have been written, that's not quite so clear. But there are some hints. There are some hints. Early on, it was thought it was in this latter part of the first century. And I'll just tell you that scholars generally think it's somewhere between 80 and 100. Somewhere between 80 and 100 A.D. Okay, and that's later than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's later than the other books. It's about the same time. Because of certain thing, I can't read Greek, of course, so I can't tell you. But they can read; they can tell. Scholars say that the books of 1st, 2nd, 3rd John were written right about the same time as the Gospel. They all come from the same basic time frame. Now, what does it mean if John was written 80, 90 A.D.? What was different? What was different between the world that, let's say, Matthew, Mark, and Luke were written in and the world that the book of John was written in? And I want to open this up. You know, we've talked about and you've studied the New Testament on your own. What's different in, let's just pick 90 A.D. All right, what's different in 90 A.D. from what's different in that world compared to the world that the other Gospels are written in, somewhere in the 60s probably? What was different 30 years later?
Fall of Jerusalem. Which means what?
What happened in fall of Jerusalem?
Temple was destroyed.
No temple. And we've talked about a lot of these things. What else was different? What, and these two things actually... because the temple was destroyed and Jerusalem was destroyed, or it fell, it wasn't destroyed yet. It was destroyed in the second war, 135. Because of that, what was going on in Judaism? What was going on in the religion of the Jews? Not, I don't need details, just maybe one word. No sacrifices, yeah. The word I'm looking for is change. Yeah. Things had to change, right? There's no temple. Their whole world, the Jewish world, revolved around the temple.
They were discouraged. I mean,
huh?
They were discouraged.
Yeah, yeah. So Judaism, to put it mildly, was changing. It was beginning to become the Judaism that we have today, rabbinic Judaism, the Pharisees and their way of interpreting Scripture and their way of living and so forth came to be the dominant way of Judaism. Now, because of these three things, I guess I'll ask it this way. How did these things begin to affect the church, the Christian church? They started to grow. All right. In what ways did it grow? Who started coming to church more?
Gentiles.
Many more Gentiles in the church. All right. No temple. Judaism's changing. There's persecution of Christians. What happened in the world, and we've talked about this a little bit, what happened with the relationship between Jews and Christians? Or let's put it this way. Christians at first were Jews, right? Then the Gentiles came in to be Christians as well. And Christians could go to the synagogue. As we get later in the first century, the Jews did not welcome Christians in the synagogue. If you were a believer that Jesus was Messiah, you weren't welcome in the synagogue. It didn't make sense that Messiah was what? A criminal? Killed on a cross? They didn't want to buy that. Okay, so Judaism, let's put it this way. Christianity, I can spell. Christianity is no longer, it's in the process of no longer being a sect of Judaism. In other words, Christians initially, in the Roman Empire, it was just, you have all these Jews. Some of them believe Messiah came, some of them believe that Messiah hasn't come yet. But they're all Jews. As the first century draws to a close, there starts to be, and we've talked about this, there starts to be a division, a separation. There's that Birkat HaMimin, I can't say it right in Hebrew. There's that blessing for the heretics, or something like a benediction for the heretics, or some kind of a thing like that, euphemistically. There was a prayer added to the standing prayers in the synagogue that was condemning the heretics. Well, who were the heretics? They were the people that believed Jesus was Messiah. So you start having this division. Christians were not welcome in the synagogues. They were expelled from the synagogues. Put it that way, okay? I should put that here as something different, because that's going to come up. That's important. You'll see why a little bit. Sorry. The church starts becoming more Gentile because there's more Gentiles compared to Jews. And another thing I won't spend a lot of time talking about, but Christians at this time began, maybe we'll have to talk about it, they began to think more deeply about who Jesus was. Who he was. And do we worship him or not worship him? And so forth, and those kinds of things. It wasn't immediately obvious. Because if you were a Jew, what did you believe in? Above all other things, what did you believe in as a Jew?
One God.
One God. One God. Jesus comes on the scene. He says he's going back to the Father where he was. Ooh, that's a tough one. Maybe it took him a couple generations to figure it out. Well, you know, in the universal church, the Catholic Church, it took them centuries to figure it out, to come up with the doctrines of the Trinity and all the Christological doctrines and so forth. It took until the 5th, 6th centuries to get it all ironed out. So it wasn't an easy thing. But this is the world. I'll put down Christology. Christology means what, you know, what is... What, who and what was Jesus? What's the nature of his existence? The church is considering its Christology. These are all things that are going on in the world and in the Christian world at the time the book of John is written. Now, why does this matter? I think it matters. You can dispute with me if you'd like, but I think it matters because if you're writing the book of John, and you're writing it at maybe 90 AD, you're going to write it from a perspective that reflects your world and the issues you're dealing with in your world. I'm not saying that you invent history. I don't mean that. But you're going to focus on the things that speak to your world. Matthew and Mark and Luke focused on the things that spoke to their world. But by the time the book of John is written, it's a different world. So John, I believe, as you read through this and as you study it, I think you'll agree with me, John is focusing on things that matter more in his world. Okay? Now, I've been talking. I've got to see where I am in my notes. I don't think it's out of line to consider that the writers, all the writers in the Bible, wrote from their world at their time, from their perspective. God used that. God inspired it to give us the book that we have. It's, you know, very helpful for us. And it's very unified in the way it works. But each person who wrote that was writing in their own world from their own perspective. The miracle of it all is that it all fits together, you know, in a coherent whole, even though they all didn't know each other and cooperate in their effort. That's the Holy Spirit that did that. Okay. Let's talk about some things that are in the book of John that these events might shed some light on. Let's look. I'm going to turn to some scriptures. First of all, chapter 2, John 2. We're only going to be in the book of John. John 2 and verse 13. We'll see this term that I mentioned. It says, and the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem, John 2, 13. And we could go, you know, we could go through this whole story, and I'm not going to because it would take a long time. But what does he do? He goes into the temple, and he throws over stalls, and he does all this, you know, he doesn't like the way that all this business is going on in the temple. And you know what, we've talked about this before, but just in case you've forgotten or you haven't heard it before, you know, what kind of, or maybe you can share, what kind of business was going on in the temple that Jesus had a problem with?
Selling sacrifices.
They sold animals. Was that so bad? Would that have been awful? I don't know, but there was more to it than just selling them.
Well, they were probably making a profit.
But they all see they had both they had both sides of the deal. They could tell you that the sheep that you brought, the lamb that you brought, is not pure. You got to buy ours, okay? And what do? Well, you reach in your pocket, you get your change, and they say, "Oh, sorry, that's not a temple shekel. You got to go exchange your money. You got to go over to this table, exchange your money." And somebody's making some money on the exchange over there. And then you come back, and they make money. They had a concession going, and it was a business. It was a big business. They were. I have a friend who calls it Temple Inc. in the things that he writes, like Monsters Inc. It was Temple Inc. It was a big business. The Sadducees were in on the inside. They were in cahoots with the Romans, and that was their business. And remember, what were they afraid of with Jesus? I think it might even be in the book of John. What were they afraid? He said, you know, Jesus all popular. And what did the Sadducees fear, the people that were really wrapped up in the temple? He said, we'll lose our station. Right? Isn't that the word in the King James? We'll lose our station. You know, we'll lose our status, our position, our freedom to do business like this. They're worried about that. They're worried about the money. Okay. Well, that's all side here. But anyway, he goes in and this going on in the temple was offensive to Jesus, and he just knocked it all over. He said, "Stop. Stop making my father's house a den of thieves," or whatever else he calls it. Okay? So he's already making himself not very popular with these people, right? You know, he brought it on himself, but he had a good reason to do that. Let's see what else I want to read here. But the point is, I want to say, it says the Jews' Passover. Now, Hugh covered this in a sermon. He's saying, why would John have to write the Jews' Passover? Like, duh, don't you know? You know. Well, because we would assume, because he says this 64 times, he talks about the Jews, and sometimes he says something like the Jews' Passover. Well, if it's you don't have to explain to the Jews that they have a Passover, right? So who are you explaining this to? Who's your audience?
Gentiles.
You know, it seems apparent that the book of John was written to primarily a Gentile audience. Why is that? Well, we haven't had a temple maybe for 10, 20, 30 years. You know, the world is different. It's becoming more Gentile, less Jewish, wherever John was writing from, probably Ephesus. So, you know, the world is different now. You can't assume that everybody's going to know that Passover is the Jewish feast, because they haven't had a temple to keep the feast at for years, maybe a whole generation. The world's different. So that's why you got to get yourself in their sandals, okay? It's not, the Bible world just wasn't the same for 2,000 years. It changed. And it changed a lot after 70 AD. Okay, do I want to cover anything else here? It just refers, right in here, this area here, it just talks about the Jews again and again. It talks about the Jews. In chapter 5, in verse 10, it says, the Jews therefore said unto him that was cured, it is a Sabbath day. I said, the Jew, who are these Jews? Okay, these Jews are a problem for Jesus, apparently. Because it says in chapter 5 here, you know, he took up his bed and walked and so forth, and I want to skip down to verse 14. It says, Jesus found him in the temple, and the man departed, and it was told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him whole. And therefore did the Jews persecute Jesus and sought to slay him because he had done these things on the Sabbath. Okay, now, this is an important verse because it teaches us something. Was Jesus popular or not popular? He was pretty popular. When you get to, is it chapter 12? In chapter 12, I think it is. And he came to Jerusalem at the final Passover. The book of John talks about three Passovers, as Hugh pointed that out in the sermon. That we know that his ministry was at least 3 years, which in the synoptic gospels you can't tell that. But in John, we get three Passovers. And here's the last one. In John chapter 12, it says in verse... This is after Lazarus had been resurrected. Verse 11, they had reason of him that many of the Jews... went away and believed on Jesus, and on the next day, much people came to see, were come to the feast, and they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. They took branches of palm trees, and they went forth to meet him, right? And you know, King hailed him King, Hosanna, and he spread the way with the palm trees, and he rode down on the donkey and all that. You know the story. Well, he was popular, right? Now, the point of me turning here is that to show that Jesus was popular, and he was popular among who? His own people, the Jews, right? And so when we read in chapter 5 that the Jews sought to kill him, now we have to start thinking a little bit here. Did the same people who put the branches down in the road for him want to kill him? No. I mean, we know that. So who wanted to kill him?
Leaders.
So when you read the book of John, most of the time, when you see, just read, and you read through it like a story, like a novel. When you see the term the Jews, it's talking about people like the Pharisees or the Sadducees or the leaders, the people who had position and standing in society. They felt threatened by Jesus because the people liked him. So when you read about the Jews here, that's the Jewish leadership that wanted to kill him. And the book of John has been used in a bad way for 2,000 years by people who are anti-Semitic. And say, look, excuse me, the Jews are the Jesus killers, and blah, blah, blah. You know, well, no. The leadership. You know, they just happen to be Jews. Any leaders would have been jealous of him. So we don't want to, you know, don't say or don't believe when people say that the book of John is anti-Semitic. It's not. when it's talking about the Jews and how horrible they were and that they wanted to kill him, it's talking about the leadership that felt threatened by his popularity among the average Jewish people. Okay? So, the church is becoming more Gentile. John is written saying about these Jewish leaders and that they were causing problems for Jesus during his ministry. Now, I can't prove this, but I'll throw this out now. I'll make a claim, and you'll see where I'm going with some of these other points. I think it makes sense to look at this list we put here and say, well, you know what? The Christians were getting expelled from the synagogue. The Christians were not considered a sect of Judaism. There was a division between the Gentiles and the Jews in the church, in the world, and that John's focus on Jesus' ministry, the years of his ministry, and the fact that he had problem with these Jewish leaders is a reflection of, you know what I'm going to say here? Might be a reflection of the problems that the Christians were having at 90 AD or 100 AD or whenever this book was written with the Jewish leadership. They were getting kicked out of the synagogues. They weren't welcome in Jewish society. Is it possible? I think it is. I think it makes sense. I enjoy studying this kind of stuff. It makes sense to me that John, writing at the time he was, experiencing what he and his community around him were experiencing, decided to focus on Jesus' life in a way that showed that, hey, this is nothing new. The founder of our religion had to deal with this a couple generations ago. Why should we be surprised that we have to deal with it now? So he's writing a message of encouragement in a way, saying, look, our leader's been here before us. There's nothing new under the sun here. So I think it stands to reason. A lot of scholars say the same thing, that the book is a reflection of the community and that the desire, the focus of the book has to do with the real world troubles that they were having at the time the book was written. For instance, I shouldn't say for instance. Let me cover one other thing here. It talks about the Jews, the Feast of Tabernacles comes up in chapter 7. But in chapter 8, beginning in verse 32, I like chapter 8, verse 32, because that's the motto of the college, university that I went to. The truth will make you free. And then we continue on. We have this discussion. And they say, the Jews say, what do you mean free? We're children of Abraham. We've never been slaves to anybody, which was stupid because they'd been slaves in Egypt. So I don't even know why they say stuff like that. But they did. I guess there's a reason. I can't figure out what the reason is. And Jesus starts talking about being a servant of sin and so forth. And they get into this discussion about freedom. And notice what it comes down to. You ever been in one of those conversations? It just gets worse as you go along. And you wish you just kind of could hide under the chair. Because, anything you say is going to make it worse than it already is. When I read this conversation, this reminds me of that. Not that Jesus wasn't in control. He desired that it got worse. But you just look at it. It goes from bad to worse. We're Abraham's seed. We've never been in bondage. Well, Jesus says, verse 37, I know you're Abraham's seed, but you seek to kill me because my word has no place in you. And I speak what I've seen by my father, and you do that which you have seen with your father. And they said, well, Abraham's our father. And Jesus says, well, if you were Abraham's children, you would do his works, but you seek to kill me. Abraham didn't do that. You do the deeds of your father, verse 41. And, it keeps going around in circles here for a little bit. And finally, he says, we get down to what verse is it? You know where this is going. Verse 44, you are of your father the devil. Whoa. And the lusts of your father you will do. He was a murderer from the beginning and so forth. Now, getting back to this time now. Jesus is having a dispute with his fellow Jews, specifically some of the Jewish leaders, or their flunkies that they would send out to test him and ask questions. A lot of times it wasn't the leaders wouldn't come out. They just sent, send good old, whoever, Simon Barjona, whatever. Send him out. They'll ask a question, but they're being put up to it. They all had their little posse and they sent them out. So Jesus was always being hassled by these people that were sent by the leadership. But look at what he says. Verse 45, I tell you the truth. Because I tell you the truth, you don't believe me. And here, verse 47. He that is of God hears God's word. Therefore, you don't hear them because you're not of God. All right. What does that verse do? It says, all right, you're not of God. But I think, what does it do in this context? I can't ask this question well enough that you're going to be able to answer it, I don't think. I think that verse does something. I think that verse sets the table in a certain way. He says, you know, you don't believe. Well, in the world of the 90 AD, we'll just pick that date. What point did a verse like this make? At the time of Jesus, you had people who believed Jesus, and you had people who didn't believe Jesus, but they were all Jews. And the conflict was between people who believed Jesus was Messiah and people who didn't. What did you have in this world? Well, you had not just a lot of Jews, you had Gentiles. And I think it's reasonable to say that this verse and many other ones, not just this one, is making an equation, if you want to put it this way. You can make an equation in the book of John. See if you agree with me here. That's equivalent to what do you think? Unbelievers is what I wrote. You read the Jews this and the Jews that and all this dispute, these disputes that Jesus has. In the world that followed, a generation later or two generations later, this book's being written and it says, you know, your problem is you don't believe. And that lets people know, like you, me, the people that lived in this world when John was written, all the Christians in between, that when you read about the Jews and that they want to kill Christ and they don't believe what he said, you know, that's talking about people who are unbelievers, who are opposed to the gospel. Maybe I should say a stronger term, not just unbelievers, but those opposed to the gospel, actively opposed. So that the gospel is not just about the Jews and Jesus, or the Jews and the apostles, the disciples. It's bigger. It's bigger than that. The gospel is teaching us about the struggle in the world between those who are preaching the gospel and those who are opposing the gospel. One group is children of God, right? Your father's God. The other group, their father's the devil. So it's not just the Jews. That's the type, I guess you'd say. That's what Jesus had to deal with. But it's a bigger story than that. And it's going on for 2,000 years. So I think we can learn from that. I think that has to do with the context. Just to make the point here about Christians expelled from the synagogue. The other Gospels don't make a big deal about that, but in John chapter 9 and verse 22, all right, remember the guy was healed and the leaders asked his parents, how this happened, whatever, and they said, hey, he can speak for himself, you ask him. And John, and chapter 9, verse 22, tells us why they said that. It said, they spoke this way because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if any did confess that he was the Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. If you believe Jesus was Messiah, you were going to be put out of the synagogue. Now, the other gospel writers don't talk about that. At least they don't focus on it in the same way. John chapter 12 and verse 42. There's prediction. Jesus tells the apostles that they will be put out of the synagogues, and thinking that they do God a service. Verse 42 of chapter 12. Nevertheless, among the chief rulers also many believed on him, but because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. And it appears again in chapter 16, verse 2. Well, I guess this is the prediction in 16:2. They will put you out of the synagogues. And yea, the time will come when even he that kills you thinks it does God a service. This was actually going on at the time that the book was written. Christians were being put out of the synagogue. Once again, I think it just stands to reason, it's being written to encourage the people. Say, look, we've been here before. People who believed in Jesus back when he was alive were threatened with being put out of the synagogue. In fact, some people wouldn't let on that they believed. Nicodemus came when? When did Nicodemus come to see Jesus? What's it say? Nighttime. Why did he come at night? He didn't want anybody to know. So I think that's the world that the book was written in. That's why we see some of these things being a focus on these things, which you didn't see the focus on the same things in the other three Gospels. I think it just makes sense. And I've had, as I said, these are things that didn't make sense to me. I had to study up on it because I thought, why is this book so different? Well, it's different mainly, I shouldn't say mainly, but one of the reasons is because it was written at a different time, serving a different audience for different reasons. And, you know, God saw fit to have it included in the scripture that we have as the New Testament because it teaches us a lot of things that we don't learn from the other Gospels. Christology, well, you could, you know, the whole book, but chapter 10 and verse 30. Let's see. You know, the Christians toward the end of the first century were trying to figure out, and believe me, this continued for centuries, trying to figure out who Jesus was. What was his nature? How had it all been? Because it wasn't something that was it was easy because of their history, the one God, you know, there's only one God. Well, how could this be? And you know, they didn't have a concept as modern people. We have this idea of God as a family that makes sense to us. They weren't thinking in those terms then, just that God was a father. chapter 10, verse 30. Is that what I want? Yeah, I came on the wrong page, sorry. Jesus says, I and my Father are one. Well, there are several verses that we could turn to in the book of John that say that. We're one. There are other ones that say, we're not one. We're different. Chapter 14. Verse 9. This is again where Philip says he wants to see the Father. And Jesus says, you've seen me, you've seen the Father. You know, we're one and the same. And there are other places. But if you're in 14, you look at verse 28. I think it's 28. You have heard how I said to you, I go away and I come again to you. If you love me, you would rejoice because I said I go to the Father, for my Father is greater than I am. So we're one, but he's greater than I am. And we understand that in a family sense, and that makes sense to us. But they didn't have that in the early. They didn't have that outlook. So they're wrestling with these things. I go, all right, where does Jesus fit in? And the book of John has all kinds of verses like this. I won't say they totally clear it up, but they give us a lot to work with. And in fact, the church councils of the early Middle Ages and before used the book of John many times because that's where the details came from. Right in the beginning, you know, the prologue, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was God, and the Word was with God. How does that? You know, we have our understanding of that. And the same was in the beginning of God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. Well, maybe it sounds simple to you, but it doesn't sound simple to me. It sounds complicated. It sounds like something you got to meditate on for a while, as you said in the sermon. You know, meditate on to try to figure it out. And the church had to do that. In John 17, in that prayer, you know, he says things like, he wants to, you know, what's he say in verse 1? Glorify your Son, that I may glorify you. Glorify me in verse 5 with the glory which I had with you before the world was. These are things that John saw fit to put in there because Christians were wrestling with what is the nature of Jesus? What's the nature of the relationship? And John, when you look at the book of John, It doesn't always spell it out. It doesn't have a doctrine of this and a doctrine of that, but it describes something. And John describes relationships. Jesus goes to great lengths, and we just looked at a couple of those verses, to say, my Father and I are one, but my Father's greater than I, and if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. He's explaining relationships. We could also, and I'm not going to do it now, you could go to John, 14, 15, 16, where he explains the Spirit, the Paraclete, the Comforter, and he does it in terms of a relationship. He's going to go, but the Spirit's going to come, and how this all works. And the church spent hundreds of years trying to digest it because it was something you really had to meditate on. And maybe we don't have all the answers. That's fine. I don't think it's simple. I don't think it's simple. I think it's complicated. And maybe we don't have all the answers. We won't understand until, as they say, we're on the other side. You know, there's things that our brains can't comprehend because we're not there. We're not spirit. So they were considering their Christology. You know, who and what was Jesus? And you see that reflected in the book, more so than you see it in the synoptics. You hardly see it at all in the synoptics. Jesus is treated like a man, born of Mary. Born of Mary from a special miracle, they get the birth stories, but not as somebody who came, who preexisted. So John is giving us a different angle here, some different information. Okay, one other thing that I think relates to the world, and Hugh brings up some of this in his sermon. Again, please listen to it. Refresh yourself on it. John 1:1 talks about the word, logos, okay? It's a Gentile, basically a Gentile concept. It's not a concept from the Old Testament. The Old Testament had wisdom, okay? But it didn't, and it had the word, you know, God's word, but using it as a philosophical term was a Gentile thing. So John is taking a term from the outside world and using it and applying it to God and his way and his world. Paul did the same thing, right? He goes to Mars Hill. He says, there's this tomb, to the unknown God, something to the unknown God, and he starts explaining. So he finds it a place of where we can agree on something, and then he takes off from there. John does the same thing. Logos. You know about a logos? Okay. A first cause. That's the way it was used among the Greeks. A first cause. Well, that first cause was Jesus. Oh, okay. So you start with something that they already know about, and then you say, okay, and you bring that concept together, and you explain something. And I think John does that. He does it with logos. He does it with truth and freedom, as I said in verse 32 of chapter 8. The truth will make you free. Truth was a big deal to the Greek philosophers. Knowledge. Gnosis was a big deal to the Greeks, and John talks about that you will know God and know his Son, whom he's just sent. All the comments here about the Jews, the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles, I could turn there, I'm not going to, the Jews' Passover. It's obvious to me and most people that read it that this book was written to a largely Gentile audience because you wouldn't have had to explain what the Feast of Tabernacles was to Jews. They already knew. You had to tell the Gentiles that the Jews had this feast, and that's where Jesus was going to go. Okay. If you combine all of these things and combine the verses that I just showed you, I think a way to explain it is you find that we have a message to a church at the end of the first century, that's kind of finding a new identity for itself. And that's not a bad thing. They've gotten kicked out of the synagogue. They're not a sect of Judaism anymore. So what are we? And John goes to some great length using these conversations between Jesus and the Jewish leaders and people that came to him, like Nicodemus and so forth, who was a leader. He was on the Sanhedrin. He uses these conversations to flesh out that relationship. Like, what are we? Who are we? Who is Jesus? Who was he? Who is he? They had to answer these questions in a different way because they were being thrust out of the institutions that they had always been a part of. So now they had to come up with at least slightly different answers. They couldn't tie everything to the Judaism that had been a part of their lives because now it wasn't going to be a part of their lives. And in that sense, this is me talking and not any scholars, I didn't read this, but in that sense, this is a somewhat modern book. It's written to people like us that didn't, I don't think any of us have spent time in a synagogue. We didn't grow up in a synagogue. So the book of John speaks to us. How do we view our religion? How do we view our Savior? Okay? So, in the late first century, the church was rethinking what it was. And they were rethinking who their founder was. And the book of John, I believe, is a big part of the answer to those questions. Okay, in the next few minutes, what I'd like to do is cover a little bit of the structure of the book. And this will tie in. And I'm not going to go through the whole entire book. But most people who study the book of John, and some people spend their whole lives studying it, they come up with really two big divisions, but there's other little parts. The first part would be the prologue. That's John 1, verses 1 to 18. Okay, the part about the Logos, and then in verse 17, where it says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. I believe that's verse 17. And no man has seen God at any time. No, that doesn't say it there. It's before that, but Word became flesh is 14. But down to verse 18 is called the prologue. It's added on. And then we get to verse 19, and it starts talking about John the Baptist, okay? From John 1, verse 19, all the way through to John 12, and the end of verse 50, the end of John 12, is sometimes called the Book of Signs. And in the Book of John, miracles, what are called miracles in the other parts of the Bible, are oftentimes called signs. And what's the difference between a sign and a miracle? Maybe nothing, but do those words have a different connotation, perhaps? Think about the words. Why would John use the word sign more often than miracle? Any ideas? John, I think, is an explainer. I think he's explaining. Lucy, you got some explaining to do. You know, he's explaining things. That's why you got the long conversations. You get the why. Excuse me. And a sign, a miracle is a miracle. A miracle is something, an event that happened. But a sign, I think, the word, and Jim would know the word better than I would. You know, it seems to me that there's a context in there of not just an event, but also a meaning attached to the event. Does that make sense? A sign, the word sign by its nature includes more than just the thing itself. There's something attached to it, a purpose, a reason, or you know, something attached to it. And I think that's on purpose. I think that it's called the Book of Signs by scholars, but it's because that John himself uses these terms signs, because these weren't just things that Jesus did. They were things that Jesus did for a reason, for a purpose, and they had a meaning. And they told us a little bit about him and who he was. So the Book of Signs is all the way from here, verse 1, chapter 1 and verse 19, all the way to the end of the end of chapter 12. Then chapters 13 through 20 are referred to as the Book of Glory, which has to do with Jesus' trial, his last meeting there with the disciples, and his trial, and his execution, and his resurrection. And it's written up differently in the book of John. We'll get into this in some future sermon, but it's interesting. And I didn't notice it. And, you know, I don't know. You look, you say, well, you're reading all the narratives, and you read them all at the same time, and you don't notice these things. But the Matthew, Mark, and Luke, when it talks about Jesus facing his crucifixion, he's a real man. He's somewhat afraid to a bit. And you know, all those kind of things, and those come out. And he doesn't say a whole lot of this trial. When you read it in John, he has more of a determination, more of a, I'm going through with this. And I'm sure there were both sides. I'm not saying it was one or the other, but John's focusing on the determined Jesus that knew what was going to happen, set his face forward to go do it. And in the trials, like he's talking to Pilate, he's kind of lecturing Pilate. He's not just shutting up, he's Caiaphas too. He gets criticized for answering the high priest like this. So he's got a little bit more determination, you might say, described in the book of John. He knows that as it says in chapter 17, that yes, he's going to die, but this is all about him being glorified. Okay, and that's why it's called the Book of Glorification. usually scholars refer to chapter 21 as an epilogue, as an addition. But let's talk, if we can, just spend a few minutes on the first part, the Book of Signs, because I want to show you, I think it has to do, the reason I want to cover this now is because it has to do with the things we have up here on the board. The Book of Signs, beginning with chapter 1 and verse 19, I'm just going to briefly talk about, don't have time to read it, and I don't want to. What's it talking about in chapter 1 and verse 19? Well, it's John the Baptist. We have baptism. And I could write these things down. Maybe I should. I don't know. So John 1, we start talking about baptism. See if we can notice a thread here. Chapter 2. What do we have in chapter 2? Anybody? We're just going to move through from chapter 1 to, or chapter 2 to chapter 5. What do we have in chapter 2 at the beginning? A what? Wedding. Later on in chapter 2, where do we go? Verse 14 or so. Temple. We go to the temple. Chapter 3. What happens in chapter 3? Who comes to visit? Nicodemus. Who is Nicodemus? He's not just anybody. Who is he? No, he's not a high priest. He's a rabbi. He's not just a rabbi, but he's on the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin, I didn't say it right. He's on the council. So he is a rabbi, but he's not just any rabbi. Chapter 3, verse 25. John's disciples and Jesus' disciples get in an argument about what? What are they disputing in verse 25? No, chapter 3, verse 25. I think. Purification. About what?
Purification.
Purification. Chapter 4. Where is he in chapter? What's going on in chapter 4 at the beginning? Why, he goes to where? He goes to Samaria. And where does he go?
He's at a well. No?
Goes to a well. Is it, what well is it? Just any well?
Jacob's well.
Jacob's well. It's a special well. Specifically, it's Jacob's well. It's got some history here. And I want to put in parentheses here, obviously, water, as you said. Later on in chapter 4, verse 31, what's he talk about there? Talks about food. And when we get to chapter 40, I'm sorry, not chapter, I'm saying chapter, I apologize. Verse 46, who comes to visit? He's back in Canaan, by the way. And we have some, I don't know who he was, but he was nobility. All right, look at the list here. Baptism, wedding, temple, rabbi, Sanhedrin, purification, Jacob's well, water, food, nobility. Do these have anything in common? Can you find something that ties them together in any kind of way? I'm not looking for something profound here, just.
I was going to say Christian life, but that.
Well, it's life. It's life. It's their life.
Yeah.
These are the cultural institutions. Baptism was a big part of the washings that they had. Wedding, that was a big social occasion. Temple, their whole religious life revolved around the temple. Rabbi, Sanhedrin, told them what to do. Purification, all the time, you know, up to the elbows, up to this, up to that. You couldn't eat, couldn't do anything without going through the right purification rites. And there was the rabbis that told you what those rites were. They weren't all from the Bible. Jacob's well, so some sacred well. It wasn't just any well, it was Jacob's well. Water, food, nobility. All these things are the culture. The Jewish culture. The pre-70 AD Jewish culture. So after 70 AD, we didn't have that. We had rabbis, you still had Sanhedrin for a while. But certain things were done away. In each of these occasions, there's something going on, but then Jesus is involved in the occasion, and I could turn to particular verses, but I'm not going to. He gives a different slant on the occasion. There's something to learn. I will give you the water that you won't have to drink again. He talks about food actually later on more. Nobility, he's king. Purification, they've gotten all kinds of disputes about that. But, Jesus showed that those things were, they're extra. They weren't even biblical. Temple was destroyed. What is the temple? Well, God dwells in us. He doesn't dwell in a building made with hands. So Jesus gives different meaning to all these things. Why is that important to the world that John was writing to? Because there's no temple anymore. Society was changing. And in fact, in another 30 years or so, the Jews were going to be kicked out of Jerusalem. And really, things were going to go bad then. So, the world had changed quite a bit. I look at all these things, and by the way, just so you know, this happened in Cana, and this happened in Cana. Now, I hope this doesn't bother anybody. I don't believe that John, for instance, this book, is written necessarily in chronological order. I believe it's written in thematic order, that there's a pattern to what is written in order to give us a message and give the original audience a message. And it's not necessarily trying to say, this happened on this day and this happened the next day at 7 o'clock. That's not important to the story. The importance of the story is that the Jewish culture was being, that gave them a reason to live and how to live. You ever watch Fiddler on the Roof? We all know what our part is to play. We know what God expects of us, right? You see in the beginning of the Fiddler on the Roof. We know what our role is, and we know what God expects of us. They were no different back then. They knew what their role was. They knew what God expected of them. And then after 70 AD, everything gets turned upside down. Now what? The book of John's written to show that there's different answers now. Those answers have to do with Jesus and how he interacts with these things and how he interacts with you. All right, one more thing. It's just more of the same, actually. When we start in Cana, we end up in Cana. That's a nice little package, right? Then we move on to chapter 5, I guess, yeah. What's chapter 5? There was a feast of the Jews, all right? We got a feast. And then it talks about things happening on what? The Sabbath. I won't write these down. The Sabbath in chapter 5. In chapter 6, look at chapter 6. What verse? I didn't write that down. Verse 4. The Passover, the feast of the Jews, was nigh. So now we have Passover. And in, chapter 5, they talk about bread. We got bread involved again. Here we go with bread. And you know what chapter 6 is all about. We don't go into that. Maybe you'll get a sermon like around Passover and unleavened bread about that. But Jesus says, I am the bread of life, right? So at the time when everybody's mind is on manna, he says, so your fathers ate this manna and they're dead. You eat this bread and you'll live forever. Whoa, okay? We have different meaning. Same holy day, different, some added meaning to it, okay? That's in chapter 6, verses around verse 30 and so on. Chapter 7, we're at the Feast of Tabernacles. And they have, you know, he says, if you come to me for living water. Anybody remember, what's living water, by the way? Technical term in the Bible, or for Jews. What is living water?
Flowing.
Water that's natural flowing. Stream, rainfall that hasn't been bottled up yet. that could be living water. And you had to be baptized, or your mikvahs, they weren't baptized, your mikvahs where you were washed, that was supposed to be living water. It's supposed to come from a stream or a spring or from rainwater, not from stagnant water. And Jesus says, well, the real living water, because they had a water pouring ceremony at the feast. They went down to the Pool of Siloam. They got this thing of water. They came up and had all these branches, and they poured some water and had this ceremony at the feast. It wasn't something in the Bible. It's just something they had as a tradition. And Jesus said, you know, that's water, okay, but if you want living water, come to me. So we have the Feast of Tabernacles, but we have new additional meaning, right? In chapter 10, Feast of Dedication, what we call Hanukkah today, without all the trappings of Hanukkah. So the bottom line is, you go through chapter 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and you have the same holy days, but now with Jesus involved, we have new insight and new meaning. Jesus gives insight and meaning to the festivals that we didn't have before. Why does this matter? Because the other board that I already raised, the world was changing. They didn't have the temple. So what are we supposed to make of the feast? We can't even go to the temple and keep the feast. What do they mean now? John, the book of John is helping to answer those questions, which are new questions, because now the world is upside down from the way it used to be. Okay, to recap, we've got a book that's written toward the end of the first century. I believe it's written by the Apostle John, seems to be, addressing in a different way Jesus' life, from not all the parables, all the stories, but, you know, long conversations, which we, you know, you had sermons on. We may do it in one of the future ones. Giving new insight into culture or into festivals or whatever. Helping Christians to find their way in a world that is radically different than the world that Christianity started in. Helping them to find their ways, their way. I think that's what the book does. And it kind of excites me to see this because I love to get the context. And the context of this book is so different than the context of the other three Gospels. And that helps explain to me why the Gospel itself is so different than the other three. Because it's a different world that it was written in. And it was written for a different purpose, different reason. The world was changing. Christians needed an answer, just like we do today, because the world's always changing. And we need answers. We need to understand. Then, as now, the anchor in a changing world is what? Or who? It's Jesus. You know, that's no different. He is still our anchor. He gives timeless meaning, meaning that does not change. Temple or no temple, Jesus is the bread of life. That doesn't change. Okay? That doesn't change. His identity is timeless. The meaning that he gives and the vision that he gives us is timeless. So the message that the late first century church needed to hear is the same message we need to hear today. So I hope that this context helps make it come alive a little bit. Next time, which will be 2 weeks from now, we're going to explore a little bit more detail, the themes. There are several themes. I don't know if we'll go through them all, but themes, things that appear again and again as we go through the book of John. We'll look at those themes in 2 weeks when I speak again.